Okay, so thank you very much. I'm Ken Harris from Rutgers, and I'm going to be telling you about some work we did looking at simultaneous recordings of large populations of neurons in behaving animals initially. Later I'm going to, and that stuff is all published with the behaving animals. Later I'm going to get down and tell you some new unpublished stuff concerning the difference between a behaving animal and a sleeping or anesthetized animal. In other words, what's missing in the anesthetized brain, what's not working at the population level that's now not allowing the animal to process information. That's some new unpublished stuff, but I'm going to start with the published stuff about how to work with and draw conclusions from large numbers of simultaneously recorded neurons in the brain. Okay. And this is an unprecedented opportunity to learn how the neural circuits work. To be able to listen to 100 neurons even at the same time is completely unprecedented. It should give us all sorts of new insights. But what we need to do now is develop techniques that allow us to use the data, which we can now collect. There is no statistical methods or other analytical methods to use this type of data to draw biological conclusions. And that's what I'm going to tell you about today, some new methods for doing that. Okay, so let's just start with a bit of background. So I guess, actually, everyone here is a neuroscientist, right? No. Okay, how many people have ever seen this picture before? Okay, that's not so bad. Right, okay. Okay, so I guess that at least half of us know that it's often thought that the brain is organized as a hierarchical system. So for those that may not have seen this before, these are different brain areas, The lines represent connections, and they're arranged vertically because the point is that you can distinguish two types of projection in the brain based on the characteristics of where the synapses go. I won't get into the details of that. But basically, there's a difference between what you can call feed-forward projections and feed-back projections. And that allows you to arrange the brain in a hierarchical manner. This leads itself to a certain way of thinking, which would be that information comes in. Sorry, is there some sort of a pointer anywhere? I see some chalk. Ah, okay, right, great. Okay, so information would come in, for example, in the retina, and it would be processed by successive stages, each one building on the results of the previous one, making the information in a slightly more complex representation until the animal has sensory information in a format that's suitable for guiding behavior. That's one theory, and that's basically thinking of a feed-forward way of processing. And it's been quite a successful approach, but there are a lot of ways in which this is at best incomplete. So it's the feed-forward arrow there, just to talk about what I was talking about. And here you can imagine information coming into these neurons. These neurons represent the information differently, and so on up the hierarchy. But there are a lot of ways in which this bottom-up picture is incomplete. So the first is the anatomy. There are as many recurrent and top-down projections as there are bottom-up projections. It's a very large hole in the feed-forward picture. Another thing is, okay, suppose there was a feed-forward architecture. Then, if you present the same stimulus to an animal twice, you would expect exactly the same response from a cell. And in the retina, this is a pretty good approximation. You present the same signal to the retina under identical conditions twice, you get the same spike train from a single cell. But as you go up the hierarchy, this gets less and less true, until eventually in high-level areas, such as the hippocampus, you can get very, very different responses to the same behavior or the same stimulus, even though you've controlled everything as best you can. And you couldn't get that from a feed-forward architecture.
Basically, you can if you allow time lag, I mean, time. You need to control very, you need to control very, very long.
Right. So, okay, it's a very good point. So, Let me see, can I get on this blackboard at all? So the point is, let's assume that the brain is a deterministic system, right? Then you've got the output. What's the brain for? This is what the best thing the behaviorists ever did, was characterize what the brain is for. The brain is for moving muscles and producing gland secretions. That's all the brain does. That's all it's for. And so you've got the muscular movements at a particular moment in time. And those are a function of the sensory inputs at that same moment in time. But they may also be a function of sensory inputs at previous moments in time. And that's really got nothing to do with whether it's feed forward or feed back. That's just causality. So what I'm trying to say here is, if there was a feed forward system, from what we know about neurons, they're not particularly good at storing information over long periods of time, other than perhaps through modification of synapses. But let's not go there. The point is that a strictly feed-forward system, information would flow through the system, and once it's gone, it's gone. Whereas if you have recurrent loops, you can imagine some sort of self-sustaining activity. I'm going to get into much more about this in detail. This is basically the theory of the cell assembly. Okay, that's basically all I was trying to say here. And the third way that this feed-forward picture is incomplete is at a psychological level. There are all sorts of behaviors that animals can do, which you could call top-down behaviors, memory, producing different reactions to the same stimulus in different contexts, that it's very hard to imagine how a feed-forward architecture could perform these functions. So these are all some holes in this simple feed-forward picture. So what's an alternative? What's an alternative way of thinking about the brain? And that there is a very old idea, now at least 50 years old, based on the cell assembly. So what is the cell assembly? So the idea is, the cell assembly is a group of neurons which are spread over different areas of the brain, amongst which recurrent synapses, excitatory connections, have been strengthened by synaptic plasticity. And what this does is it allows the neurons to fire synchronously. So you are able to have self-sustaining activity within the assembly. Once enough members of the assembly are firing, they will excite the others, which will excite others, and the whole assembly will be able to maintain its own activity through recurrent excitation. And that will manifest itself by synchronous firing of these cells. They will all fire at approximately the same time. And this is the really important point, that in order to get a cell assembly to fire, it's not enough. You can get a cell assembly to fire by presenting appropriate external sensory input, but it's also possible for the cell assembly to fire purely because of factors internal to the brain, such as the activity of another cell assembly. So to make this a bit clearer, suppose you were in the visual system and you're recording from a population of cells, and you were stimulating visually with a strobe light flashed once every second. So you would expect to see some synchronous activity at 1 hertz, simply because you're stimulating them together. What the cell assembly hypothesis would predict is that you have more synchrony than you would expect based on that 1 hertz stimulation. The neurons are more synchronous than expected by external control, because they're responding to internal factors as well as external factors. And this was Hebb's model for how the brain could perform these cognitive processes other than simple sensory stimulus response associations. What I'm going to tell you about is some experimental work that's tried to look for signatures of this type of cell assembly organization in simultaneously recorded populations of neurons. We can now record at least 100, 200 neurons simultaneously in behaving animals. This is unprecedented. We should be able to do great stuff with that. But the problem is, what do we now do now we've got this data? We're sitting there with gigabytes of it on the disk. What's the next thing you do? And so I like to phrase this as a thought experiment. Suppose you could record every single cell in the brain You've got your dream data set. What is the first thing you would do with this data set? And I was fortunate enough to be able to ask this question of a very well-respected neurophysiologist recently, and he thought about it a long time and then came up with probably the best answer I've ever heard, which is that I don't know what to do with it anyway. I'll just keep one of them because at least then I know what I'm doing. So I'm a bit less pessimistic, perhaps you could say more foolish. But what I'm first going to tell you about is what we can do at a single cell level. If neurons are organized into cell assemblies, then timing is going to be really important in this, because they're organized together into synchronously firing groups in time. And we can learn a lot about this by looking at the times of single spikes in single cells. And this is going to be in the hippocampus, which I guess everyone knows, even the non-neuroscientists by now. I hope so. And then I'm going to talk about how the cells are organized together at the population level. And finally, going to talk about some unpublished work, talking about how this is, what's missing from this assembly structure in an anesthetized animal. Okay, so we're recording in the hippocampus, and just in case anyone doesn't know, the hippocampus is thought to be involved in spatial behaviors. How many people have heard of the theta rhythm? Most. Okay, good. So just for those who haven't, when a rat is exploring an environment, engaging in a spatial behavior, actually a slightly larger class of what you could call appetitive behaviors, but I won't get into that. You see this 8 hertz, almost sinusoidal rhythm in the local field potential in the hippocampus. But when he stops moving through space, the theta rhythm disintegrates, and you get this irregular pattern called large irregular activity. And you see that in non-spatial behaviors, and also in slow wave sleep, whereas the theta rhythm you see in REM sleep. And although this is a very interesting state as well, I'm only going to be talking about the theta state for now. So what is this theta rhythm for? Is it purely an epiphenomenon, or does it actually have anything to do with the functioning of the circuit? Well, it looks like it has something to do with the circuit, because if you record neurons at the same time as the theta rhythm, you see that nearly all neurons show some sort of relationship to a phase relationship to the theta rhythm. So here we have two types of interneuron, CA1 pyramidal cells, and you can see that on average, all of them tend to fire around the trough of the locally recorded theta rhythm. On average, there's a lot of variability, but on average, they all fire around the bottom. Okay, so what else do we know about when the cells will fire? So one of the other big pieces of evidence for the hippocampus being involved in spatial function is that the firing rate of a hippocampal cell is correlated with the animal's location in space. So here you can see the firing rate of a one particular cell recorded as the animal chased around this square environment after Fruit Loops, I believe it was in this case. And you can see that when he's in this area, the cell fires fast. When he's anywhere else, it hardly fires at all. And this is what you could call a place field. There's been a whole lot of experiments done on playing little tricks with the rat, rotating him without him knowing it, moving the cues around, doing all sorts of tricks to confuse him about where he is. And the basic idea is that the cell fires according to where the rat thinks he is. And you won't go too wrong if you imagine yourself as the rat. Say, if that was me, where would I think I was? That's usually quite a good intuitive way of understanding where the place cells are going to fire. But that's just the firing rate. We're interested in the timing. What do we know about the timing? Well, there's this theta rhythm. And one of the most interesting findings, remember that on average, the cells tend to fire around the trough. But that's just the average. There's a lot of variability as well. One of the most interesting findings in this field, now over 10 years ago, is that the phase of firing with respect to the theta rhythm is actually less variable than we thought, because it's correlated with the animal's location in space. So here we've got a rat running along a linear track, just in one dimension, And on the x-axis is his location on the track. And on the y-axis is the phase of firing with respect to theta of a given neuron. And I've plotted this twice, and this is the same data repeated twice, just because you don't want to have to cut it at 360. It's a circular variable, any cut is arbitrary. But what you can see is that as he moves through the place field, the phase of firing of the spikes moves forward. It moves from late in the cycle, when he first enters it. By the time he leaves, it's earlier in the cycle. And it goes about 180 degrees as he crosses the place field. And this caused an awful lot of excitement because it's what seems like the best example of what you could call a temporal code. There's been a lot of fuss about this recently, that not just the firing rate of cells could be carrying information, but the precise spike times could also be carrying information. And this seems like the best example you could ask for, because the firing time of the cell is also correlated with a variable that the cells are presumed to be representing, his location in space. And it's not that he's moving at the time scale of the theta cycle. He's not going anywhere during a theta cycle. He's moving much slower than that. But the timing is reflecting something other than his location at that precise instant. Okay, so is it a temporal code? Personally, I am of the opinion that the word code is way overused in neuroscience. What we observed here is a correlation. We see that the timing of the cells is correlated with the animal's location in space. If we're going to say it's coding for the animal's location in space, we need to actually define what we mean by a code. And the truth is that when most people use the word code, all they mean is correlation anyway. That's all they mean. And we could just look at this and say this is therefore a code because it's a correlation. But if we want to be serious, we've got to have some way of knowing that this actually is the function of the cells. This is what they're for. The word code means more than just a correlation. It means this is a functional property of the cells. Yes, sir?
I'm confused because location depends on which environment.
Yes. Okay, so that's a very good point, and there's been a lot of experimental work trying to address these particular issues. So one thing that's often done is to have the same rat explore two different environments. So he might be in a square box over here, and a round box over here, and a triangular box over there. And what you see is a mixed picture. It depends precisely where you're recording in the hippocampus. But the basic idea would be that most place cells would have a place field in one environment and not have a place field in any other environment. If it so happens that they did also fire in another environment, then the location that they fire at in that environment is usually not related to the location they fired at in the first environment. There are exceptions to this rule that are becoming more and more clear. For example, if you take a square environment and you slowly change it until eventually it's a round environment. They have this group in Norway have this environments with these very flexible walls that they use for this. You can make the cell continue to fire in the same corner of the environment. But if you very suddenly change everything, the rat thinks he's in an entirely new place. All of the place cells either stop firing or shift their firing fields completely. That's called remapping. So it's certainly not as simple as X and Y coordinates. It's more complicated than that. And the same would go for the space, the firing phase, which fires follows the firing rate very well, as we'll see in a moment. Okay, but anyway, so is it a code for space? If it's a code for space, then that's all these cells are doing. So what that would mean is that these fluctuations would be random. They would just be noise. And the way we looked at that is that we had the animals run in a wheel. And when they're running in a wheel, you get theta, but they're not moving through space. Their head location is fixed. So if there was a code for space, you would expect that either the phase of firing was constant or it was completely random. In fact, that's not what we saw. So here we've got a rat running in a wheel. He enters a wheel here, and he leaves here. And you can see that other than a slight oscillation as he goes back and forth in the wheel, he's not moving. So you might expect that the cell would have a constant phase, but that's not actually what happens. In fact, it doesn't even have a constant firing rate. About 5 seconds into the wheel, the cell suddenly starts firing like crazy. Now, we don't know why. We don't know what happened. We didn't do anything at 5 seconds. Nothing apparently changed in the environment. Presumably, the change was somewhere in the internal cognitive processes of the rat that happened at 5 seconds that caused the cell to start firing. We don't know. But what's really interesting is that when it starts firing, it follows exactly the same sort of phase procession you would get if he was running through the place field. And what this suggests is that it's not really explicitly to do with space at all. It's just a property of something these cells always do. And that would suggest that... So basically, there's a relationship between spike phase and firing rate, which is that when the cell starts firing, you tend to get a phase procession. And this happens in spatial or non-spatial behaviors. And it suggests that the phase procession isn't the whole story. It's just one aspect of something deeper that spike timing is involved in. And what might that be? Well, I'm going to propose that this is something you can only understand at the population level. And that the phase procession is just what you see when you only look at one cell. And to really understand what's going on, you have to look at a population of cells, and there you'll see that the phase procession is a consequence of the organization of the neurons into cell assemblies. Okay, so now we have to bite the bullet and do the hard thing, and look at the population altogether. So what is it we're looking for? Okay, how are we going to know if we've seen a cell assembly? So the first thing we'll see is spatially distributed groups of cells that fire synchronously. But the point I tried to make earlier, it's not enough just to see synchronous firing, because you could have synchronous firing caused by a stimulus which the cells all respond to. What you need is that the synchrony you see exceeds what you would predict from their common modulation by the external input, which in this case we're going to assume is the animal's location in space. And finally, the point is that one cell can belong to many cell assemblies. However, not every subset of the cells in the brain constitutes a cell assembly. As a consequence, you should see statistical preferences in those cells that a given neuron chooses to join with in assembly activity, in firing synchronously. Yes?
You're just defining a cell assembly by saying it's that group that fires synchronously, or why must they fire synchronously?
Okay, so the theory of the cell assembly is certainly not my theory. It's a very old idea. What I'm trying to do here is not define the cell assembly, but say, how will we look for it in the experimental data? These.
By synchronously, I mean, can there be phase log, you know, 180 degrees out of phase, like two cells in a cell assembly? So by synchronously, you mean exactly the same phase, or you just mean phase log?
I mean a population of cells that fires at the same time.
Okay.
Now, they're never going to fire at exactly the same nanosecond. No one would expect that. And similarly, the fact that they fire on the same day doesn't really qualify them to be a member of a cell assembly. So there is a question of what is the time scale of synchrony for the definition of a cell assembly. And that's something that we can actually address experimentally. I'm going to come onto this a bit later, and we actually get a number out for what that time scale is. The point you're making of could you have a cell assembly with certain timing relationships within it, that you have this one always fires at the beginning and this one always fires at the end. That's something I haven't yet looked at. It's possible. If you go back to the original theory in Hebb's book, this isn't part of the theory. What is part of the theory is that what he called the phase sequence, which is a chain of cell assemblies, each one leading to the next one firing. And it's really even a good question whether there is a difference between a sequence of cell assemblies and a sequence of cells within an assembly. These are important issues, but they're ones I haven't yet looked at. So the definition for now, at least, is the original one, that that you have a group of cells firing at the same time, and we're going to try and answer the question of what is the appropriate time scale from the data. Okay, did someone else have a question?
You could also have to answer how often they would have to fire in synchrony, not just whether or not it's the time scale, but what fraction of the time.
Yes, so the definition we're going to take is more than the prediction by external sensory input. I'm going to get onto this in more detail later, but basically what we do is we say, suppose the only thing controlling the cells was the external input, which in this case we're assuming to be the animal's trajectory through space. Then how much synchrony would we expect from that? If we see more synchrony than that, then we can conclude that that's not the full story, and the cell assembly hypothesis is an attractive alternative. Then we can ask whether the rhythmic modulation is the entire story. And if that doesn't turn out to be the entire story, we can suggest that it's not that the rhythms cause the grouping of cells together, but the other way around, that the relationships of the cells to the theta rhythm is a consequence of something else. But I'm going to come up to all of this later on. Okay, so just to try and illustrate it a bit more, and to illustrate why we need to record large numbers of cells, suppose we recorded just two cells, and we saw this irregular spike pattern. You always see irregular spike patterns, and you never really know what it means. So one possibility is that the irregularity is simply noise, it's just random, and that the downstream cells are only going to average over these complex patterns anyway. So the irregularity doesn't matter, it tells us nothing. That's one possibility. But another possibility is that it wasn't actually random at all. It's actually a sign of an organization of cells into assemblies. But you can't see that by only looking at two cells. You can only see that when you record from a large population. And this is what we're looking for. If we see this type of thing, that will strengthen our confidence in this old idea of assemblies. Okay, so let's look at some actual data. Here we have a group of cells recorded from the hippocampus. This is of about 100 in this recording. These are about 30 that fired in a given second of data. And they're arranged on the screen by their anatomical location. The different recording sites are color-coded. And within each of these bars, you have a vertical organization of the cells according to their vertical organization on the electrode shank. These are Michigan silicon probes, by the way, so you can tell where along the shank you're recording them. Okay, so if you take a long, hard look at this rastogram here, you will probably see very little indeed. There's no apparent organization of this firing at all. But that doesn't mean it's not actually there. It just means you can't see it in this data because your eye isn't good at picking it out. So what I'm going to do is simply rearrange these spike trains so that now instead of being organized by their anatomical location, they're organized functionally so that synchronously firing groups of cells are displayed close to each other. Now we see something like this. This is exactly the same data, just displayed differently. You can see certain groups of cells that fire at certain times, and other groups of cells that fire at other times. So how do we do it? Okay, so I'm glad you asked that question, because not many people do. Okay, so for every pair of cells, we first define a metric of how close they are, which is based on basically the number of coincidences, simultaneously occurring spikes. That gives us a matrix of, and we think of that as distances between the cells. The more synchrony there is, the shorter the distance. Then in order to arrange them linearly, we have to solve the traveling salesman problem and find the shortest route through this distance matrix which corresponds to the organization in which those synchronous cells are closest to each other. Now, the traveling salesman problem is incredibly difficult, as everybody knows, but it doesn't matter here because this is just an illustration. This isn't statistics. This is just a pretty picture that gives us the impression that we're on the right track. We're going to go and do the statistics later by a different method. So the fact that we haven't found the global maximum of the traveling salesman problem actually isn't a concern here. This is an exploratory analysis. So we just solve it by a simple hill climbing algorithm. And that gives something usually that looks a lot like this. It isn't necessarily the global maximum, but in fact, there's no reason to think that the cells are organized in any way in one dimension at all. It's just that we can only display one dimension. This is just a visual aid. Yes? The different rows. Okay, so each row corresponds to a single neuron. So so let's start on this one. Okay, so these four yellow rows are four of the cells recorded on this electrode that happened to fire during this 1 second. There was about three times as many cells as this, but two-thirds of them didn't fire in this 1 second of data. And these are the spikes. The x-axis is time, and at the bottom you see the theta rhythm simultaneously recorded. And the vertical lines correspond to the troughs of the theta rhythm. And these are just rastergrams. These are the times of the spikes. And here, when you look at it here, you don't see much. But when you look at it here, you see that there are groups of cells that are spread across the electrode that seem to be functionally related. But the point is, this is just an exploratory analysis. How do we know that these just aren't just random fluctuations? That's what I'm coming to next, is a statistical method to do this. And there are not statistical methods to do this. This type of data, multivariate point process data, isn't just new to neuroscience, it's new to science. I haven't seen any, and I've been reading the literature of all sorts of different fields, this type of data just hasn't cropped up before anywhere. So there aren't statistical methods to do it yet. Right, yes. I mean, there's a handful of neuroscientists that do this, but if you compare it to continuous multivariate time series, where there have been armies of telecoms engineers working on it for the last 50 years, the statistical theory is certainly not as advanced. It's true that there are a few, Sonia Grun being a very good example, but you can count them on your fingers. Right, those okay, if it's what I'm thinking of, yes, you're right, and it's new stuff and it's good stuff. If it's what I'm thinking of, though, those weren't simultaneously recorded cells. That was the response of one cell to a repeated presentation of an identical stimulus. But it's true that it's a good point. I mean, I think the reason it wouldn't be quite as appropriate here. So the first thing is, it is very similar. It's a very similar approach to this. It may or may not be the same. I haven't read his paper in enough detail. It just came out, right, his paper. I think it just came out a month or two ago. It may or may not be similar. There are probably a few minor differences. In fact, I know what one of the differences is. He uses a clustering algorithm. So rather than arranging them in one dimension, he sorts them into groups. And that's something you can do. It may give a very similar result. It's not what we did. But listen, this is just an illustration. This is not the statistics. This proves nothing. This is just a picture. And we're not going to follow this approach to do the statistics, because there's no reason to think they actually live on one dimension anyway. Why one dimension? There's nothing about the brain that's one dimensional. Yes?
Just comment. People have studied phylogenetic trees, which is basically an analysis of genomes, which is, for that matter, the discrete signal recorded from many, many animals. I'm trying to log many cells in your case. I'm trying to cluster them into similar classes.
Yeah. So, okay. So. It's true. Okay, perhaps I overstated my case. There is certainly now a flood of discrete data. However, I'm feeling, what I was saying is, I feel jealous of people who work with continuous signals, who have all the techniques they can borrow from geophysics and such to do that, whereas this is a field, and there is a lot of research being done, and these techniques are starting to come, but they are still in their infancy. And so what I'm trying to say is, we need to continue developing new techniques. And we may be able to borrow some techniques from genomics. Personally, I'm not so convinced, because there's no continuous time in genomics. But this really isn't the point. We're getting on quite a sidetrack here. Because this is just an illustration anyway. Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so here's another of the techniques that's often used, which is, you can call it stimulus decoding. So we know that if we're recording in the hippocampus, we have a population of cells, and the firing rates and times of those cells correlates with the animal's location in space. Okay, we know that. So one thing that's often done is to take these firing rates and use it to reproduce the animal's location. The decoding paradigm. We're decoding the stimulus, the supposed stimulus, from the pattern of activity of the cells. And, you know, that tells us, in fact, that these cells are correlated with this stimulus. If these cells are all correlated with this stimulus, it would be very, very surprising if we could not recover the stimulus from the patterns of activities of the cells. And in fact, often when this is done, these cells weren't even recorded simultaneously anyway. The first that I know of example of this was Georgopoulos' work in the motor cortex, and he recorded cells one at a time and then formed what you could call a virtual population of these cells, recorded individually and then treated as if they were recorded simultaneously. So this isn't going to tell us about how the cells work together that allows us to use the fact that we recorded them simultaneously. And in particular, if there's another factor organizing the timing of these cells, such as, for example, an assembly organization, this paradigm will not allow us to find out anything about that mystery factor, because all this paradigm will do is reconstruct the factor that we originally knew about. Yes? Almost. There are some biases towards high firing cells, but basically, right.
So it depends also on the size of the population you are measuring.
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
So in practice, what is the size?
It's on a good day it's 100. Nowadays on a good day it's 200, but when this data was collected on a bad day it may have been 30. But it tends to low hundreds, basically. Okay. So we can make this a bit more clear. So the fact that we can reconstruct a stimulus from a population of cells doesn't show that these cells code for a stimulus, however you choose to define that word. Personally, I choose not to even use it at all, except for here. But it will work anytime the cells correlate with the stimulus. And it won't tell us that is the only function of these cells. There may be something completely different going on, and this is just a consequence of some deeper principle. And the stimulus reconstruction paradigm won't tell us that. Okay, so how can we look at it in more detail? So suppose that we have a situation like this, that the cells all correlate with a certain stimulus. Then the point is that any correlations between two of these cells, if this was the only thing controlling the cells, any correlations between the cells would only arise because of a common effect of this stimulus. They would be conditionally independent. Does everyone know what I mean by that? Does anyone know what I mean by that? Okay. It doesn't really matter. The point is the only correlations between the cells are because of a common effect of this stimulus. And if we predict this one from the stimulus, there will be no further predictability from cell 2, because everything is already taken into account. Now, however, if there was another mystery factor also controlling these cells, there would be partial correlation. So I could predict from the stimulus, but then I would be able to improve my prediction by using one of the other simultaneously recorded cells. And that's what the approach we're going to take. If we see a partial correlation, then we can conclude that these cells are not simply slaves to the assumed stimulus, but there's something else going on. And by looking at the details of the partial correlation, we can hope to understand what that something else is. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And because we're recording, can I repeat the question? Okay. So the point is, because we see this partial correlation, if we see this partial correlation, can we assume that these cells are actually talking to each other? And the answer, as you pointed out, is very definitely no. It could be that there's a third cell. It could be that this question mark is a single cell causing this extra correlations. But it could be that it's actually a very large population of cells. Now, we're recording in CA1, where there are very few recurrent connections between the cells anyway, so it's very unlikely to be that. And if you look at cross-correlations in the brain, you basically see two patterns. You see these very sharp ones with a width of about 1 millisecond, and those you usually assume are because of monosynaptic connections either between a pair of cells or a reflection of a common input to a pair of cells. The other type of correlation you see is broader, and it's about 20 milliseconds wide. And that probably isn't the result of a single common input, but from a whole population, which is only synchronized with a 20 millisecond window. Okay, and we'll come back and look at these timescales later. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to take one cell out of the population, and we're going to predict when it's going to fire as best we can. And the first prediction we make is from the place field. We just read the firing rate off the place field and make that prediction. If there was a firing rate code for the animal's location in space, this is the best prediction you could make for when the cell is going to fire. Okay, but we know that it's not that simple because we know there's a theta rhythm and the phase locking to the theta rhythm depending on the animal's location. Okay, so now we want to predict using the theta rhythm. So we can extract the phase from the simultaneously recorded theta rhythm, and we can read off the predicted phase from what you can call the phase field, which is a map of the preferred firing rate of the preferred firing phase of the cell as a function of location. And then you can use that to make a phase modulation factor, which you multiply in, and that gives you an improved prediction. If there was a temporal code for the animal's location in space, this is the best prediction you can make. Okay, now, however, if there was an organization of cell assemblies, yes? Yes. How do we estimate the phase field? Okay, this is a good question. Okay, how do we do the phase field? So could be a fairly lengthy digression. Okay, so let's start with how we do a place field. The simplest way to do a place field is to bin space and count the number of spikes in each bin and divide that by the total amount of time spent in that bin. That gives you an estimate of the firing rate. This isn't a particularly good way to do it, though, because you need to take fairly large bin chunks to do that, and then you're losing spatial resolution and you've got this kind of blocky form, which is completely wrong. So a better way to do it is with a smoothing method. You take a much, much finer bin resolution, and then you make a spike count map, which is going to be zero nearly everywhere with just a few scattered ones, and a occupancy map, which is the amount of time he spent there, and in each bin. Then you smooth both of them, and then you divide them. And you have a given smoothing scale, which is a parameter you can use, and we choose that with cross-validation to get the best possible prediction. That's how we make a place field. Now, it turns out this is equivalent to a statistical framework called local maximum likelihood. There are no zero divisors because we smooth it with a Gaussian kernel, which so the problem is, what if there was, so we're taking the number of spikes divided by the amount of time. So we run into a problem if there's somewhere that he hasn't visited at all. How do we know what the firing rate is in this area he hasn't visited? We actually don't know. And if he never visited this room, we have no idea what firing rate the cell would be in this room. So there are two ways to get around it. The first is that you smooth using a Gaussian kernel. So it's never going to be zero, but it's still not perfect, because what in practice it does is it takes the spot, the very nearest spot that he visited, and it says the firing rate at this point is going to be equal to the firing rate there. That's not the, and the good thing is, if we use cross-validation, we can quantitatively evaluate what's the best way to compute a place field, and I tried a very large number of them, and this is the one that won. And there's one slight modification that makes it even better, which is that if we add a term like this, where F here is the mean firing rate of the cell, what that effect, can you actually see this? Okay, what that effectively does is, in an area that where both of these variables are very, very small, it gives you F. It gives you the mean firing rate. So what we would do is predict that in this room where he's never been to, the firing rate is just the mean firing rate of the cell, because we have no other information. But when we get close enough to somewhere he has visited, we can extrapolate from that area. Okay, but this is all the firing rates. How do we do the phase? Okay, so the phase, the first question is, what is the type of model we're looking for? So there's something in circular statistics called the von Mises distribution, which goes something like this. It's an exponentiated cosine. When theta is equal to mu, mu is the mean phase, this is at a maximum. And this parameter k gives us the tuning intensity. If this is large, it's very sharply peaked. If it's zero, it's completely flat. And this is a normalization term which involves Bessel functions. And what we're looking for is something like this, but where k and mu are both functions of position. All I've plotted here is mu of position. We're also computing k of position, which I didn't plot. Now, we do it, in fact, by a similar method, this locally weighted likelihood. So what this is equivalent to is in fact, taking a weighted sum of the likelihood of seeing the number of spikes that was actually seen under a Poisson distribution with the likelihood of every grid segment weighted by its distance from the point you're trying to estimate. And you can, the good thing is that that sounds very complicated, but if you do the math, it turns out to be equivalent to this smooth and divide. You can actually do the same math for this von Mises distribution, and it comes out incredibly simple as well. And the way it comes out is that you for every grid segment, you accumulate e to the I theta, where theta is the phase, and then you average them. First, you have to smooth them before you average. And then you compute the phase angle of this and the modulus of this, which after a bit of manipulation give you mu and k. So that's how it's done. And what you see here is, you have to smooth it, and you can choose the smoothing scale using cross-validation, and the optimal smoothing scale is a bit larger. And what you're seeing here is mu. You're not seeing k, except in the shading of this. So the intensity here, where it's black, K is zero. Where it's very intense, K is large. So you can see that as it leaves the center, the intensity fades out, which corresponds to what you're saying, that we have less confidence in our prediction. So that's the, yes?
In all these places, you have a place in space, and you have a neuron that spikes.
Yes.
Then I go to the next place in space, and I may find a neuron completely in a different place in the hippocampus that fires. There's no relation, there's no mapping between the spatial location. The location in the brain,
a very, very good point, because in most of the brain there is a very big relationship. In the visual cortex, the position within the visual cortex corresponds one-to-one with the position on the retina. In the hippocampus there appears to be no relationship whatsoever, which is a puzzling phenomenon. Yes. No. I'm least confident in where I have least spark. I'm least confident about the phase. Why is it bright here? Oh, I think that's just a matter of the projector. Okay, so it is actually an interesting point, which I haven't looked at in detail, but it is true that when you enter a place field, you have much sharper phase locking than when you leave a place field. I never thought about this till now, but you may be right that is why this is more, K is larger here than you might expect otherwise. However, I think the fact that it looks bright here, you see in this area, which corresponds to this green region, you've still got plenty of spikes. But by the time you get down here, it really is starting to fade. And my guess is that this is just the smoothing. It's extrapolating from here what the phase will be. It is possible that it's due to this extra sharp locking of spikes as you enter the place field. I haven't looked at that enough to know. It could be one or the other. Okay, so leaving these matters to one side, we made the best prediction we can from the animal's location and from theta, but if there's more going on, we can predict even better from the spike times of the simultaneously recorded cells. So this is how we do that. We take all the other simultaneously recorded cells, and the first thing we do, and that's a discrete point process. First thing we do is turn that into a continuous process. We smooth it out in the time domain with a Gaussian function of a variable time width, which we're calling tau. And we are going to change this value and see what the effect of that is on the prediction quality. And that's one of the things that's going to enable us to look at the time scale of the assembly locking. So now we give each cell a weight, positive or negative. We make the weighted sum of these smooth spike trains, and we pass it through a nonlinear function, which I can go into the details if anyone's interested. This is what a statistician would call a generalized linear model, for those who are into statistics. But basically what it is a way of predicting when the cell's going to fire from the simultaneously recorded peer cells. And I call them peer cells for shorthand, they're just simultaneously recorded pyramidal cells. The point is there are two parameters. There's a time scale, which is the same for all cells, and there's the weight, which varies between cells. Some are positive, which predicts an increased firing probability of the target cell. Some are negative, which predicts a decreased firing probability of the target cell. And we multiply that into the spatial prediction, and we say, does this allow us to improve the prediction over the prediction we got from space alone? And there's an important detail, which is that to do this right, you have to use cross-validation. So we're fitting a large number of parameters. If we're just evaluating the prediction, we've got to be sure that the improvements we get aren't because we're fitting random fluctuations. So the way we do that is that we fit the weights on one half of the data, and then we go and evaluate the quality of the prediction on the other half of the data. And the way we evaluate it is using the likelihood of the observed spike train under the predicted intensity model, which is given by this formula, for those, and we compute the log likelihood ratio. For those who are into information theory, you can interpret that as follows. This is the number, if I wanted to tell you the spike train, this is the number of bits I save if I'm using a code based on the simultaneously recorded cells than if I'm using a code based only on the animal's location in space. That's not really important, that interpretation. The point is, this allows us to quantify whether the simultaneously recorded cells improve our prediction of when the target cell is going to fire. Okay, so let's actually look at some data now. So here's one cell that we took out of the population and called it the target cell. Here's the place field of that cell, and here's the animal's trajectory shown in white. And the first prediction you can make is just the mean firing rate. This is your baseline. This is really predicting very little indeed. But now we can say, well, we're going to read off the firing rate from the animal's location in space. That's plotted here in green, and the improvement that we get over the mean firing rate is shown here. And you can see that it does pretty well, because when it's predicting the cell's going to fire, the cell fires. When it's predicting the cell's not going to fire, the cell hardly fires. Good. But can we improve it using the simultaneously recorded cells? That's what's shown here in brown. So here we have a subset of the simultaneously recorded cells arranged by their prediction weights, with the positively predicting ones shown at the top here in red, and the negatively predicted ones shown here at the bottom in blue. And that leads to this much more spiky function here, shown in brown, corresponding to an improved temporal precision of the prediction. And using the likelihood measure, we see that this indeed improves the prediction from space alone. Yes?
Past of those cells?
No. The future of the... No. What we do, we constrain ourselves only to the simultaneously firing cells. Now, we smooth it in the time domain with this Gaussian, and that smooths into the past as well as the future. We're not trying to claim that these cells cause this one to fire.
I understand, like, you're just looking at the presence of physical relations in the firing of one cell and the other cell.
Exactly.
But now it's not the case that the cells which you use to describe the firing of your target cell could actually even in principle cause that.
We knew it wasn't possible from the word go, because this is CA1 and there's very, very few recurrent synapses between pyramidal cells. It's a reflection of a common input. So the point is, someone asked you asked earlier about whether you can have a temporal arrangement within the cell assembly. That's something we haven't looked at yet. But it's entirely possible that you have certain cells that tend to fire at the beginning of the cell assembly and certain ones that fire at the end. If we're restricting to causality, we could only predict the ones at the end from the ones at the beginning, rather than predicting the ones in the middle from the ones at the end. It's a question of what's the question you want to address. I personally think if we did, instead of using a Gaussian, we used a half Gaussian, I think we'd actually get a fairly similar result. I didn't try it because it's just not the question we want to address. There's no question that there's no causality here. Even if there was causality, and okay, so let me just show you the next thing. So here we have just a cross correlogram of the target cell and one of the positively predicting cells, and the target cell and one of the negatively predicting cells. And what you see is that with the positively predicted cell, there's a very large peak in the cross correlogram, which is fairly symmetrical, about zero. And in the negatively predicting cell, there's a dip in the cross correlogram, again fairly symmetrical, about zero. Now, if there was a monosynaptic connection, and the width of this is about 20 milliseconds. If there was a monosynaptic connection, the width would be much, much smaller. It would be 1 or 2 milliseconds. You can detect monosynaptic connections in CA1, but they're only between pyramidal cells and interneurons. And we have excluded interneurons from all of this analysis. Yes?
What's in the prediction from space settle.
Yeah, that's coming up in the next slide. Not in this slide. Only in the next slide.
Oh, so in this
In this one, we're not predicting from the theta rhythm. It just got too complicated. That comes up in the next slide. I'll show you that in just a second. In fact, okay. So anyway, the point is that this is a positively predicting cell. When it fires, the target cell is extremely likely to fire as well. The negatively predicting cell, when it fires, the target cell is very unlikely to fire as well. And this happens at a timescale faster than the theta rhythm. And by doing this, we can predict the cell's target cell spike train with a much faster temporal resolution than we can based on his trajectory through space. He doesn't move very fast through space. Yes?
So do you put the three-way terms, for example, if cell 1 fires and cell 2 doesn't fire?
We don't, no. We don't do that.
It's only, only the product terms in the linear modeling, the exponential linear modeling.
Yes, there are no...
There are no three-way products, just two-way products.
Well, it's not even really a two-way product. Okay, so if you're making, I guess you're talking about log linear models for contingency tables. So we're not doing that. We're taking one cell out of the population and we're regressing that one on the others. So there are no products at all. The point is that it's basically like this. It's just a weighted sum. Right, okay. Whether or not it is. I mean, we could have this. We could have that, but I didn't want to do that because the first thing is, what we're trying to do is test a null hypothesis, that the only thing is space. And this one's enough to do that. The other thing is that I think if we put this in, it would make the prediction much worse because we'd have so many more parameters and so much more overfitting. There's already, just with this, because we've got a large number of cells, there's already an overfitting problem. And we solve that by adding a ridge regression term to the a penalty term. But I don't think that would have improved things at all. So the phase, right? Whoops. So as you pointed out, we also need to make the prediction from phase. And that's shown here in green. So you can see that there's a sinusoidal modulation. And it does a fairly good job of predicting what phase the cell's going to fire at. At this part of the data set, the cell normally fires around the trough, and it starts to shift forward a bit here, you can see that. But what this really misses is the fact that the cell doesn't fire on every cycle anyway. So here, you see, at this point in time, it happens to be skipping cycles. Now, we don't know why it's skipping cycles. The phase precession effect doesn't predict it would skip cycles. It predicts it would fire on every cycle with a phase that slowly advances. And when you look at the typical examples, so-called, in the papers about phase precession, that's what it does. But when you look at the real data, it's never that clean. It skips cycles, it fires at the wrong phase, it does whatever it likes. But, on average, the peer cells tend to go along with it. So these simultaneously recorded, positively weighted cells tend to skip cycles in the same pattern, and when they fire on the wrong phase, they do it too. Whereas the negatively weighted cells, when this one's skipping a cycle, those ones are more likely to be firing. And in brown here, you see the prediction from the peer cells, which captures when the target cell is going to fire much better, suggesting that the phase precession effect isn't the whole story. So it's not that the phase precession effect causes the cells to be grouped into assemblies. That's the wrong way round to think of it. The cells are coordinated within the theta rhythm. The phase precession effect is something you see, on average, when you look at only one cell. But I think it's wrong to think of the phase precession effect as the whole story. It's just an observation. It's just one observation. So one of the things we've kept alluding to is timescales. And by varying this parameter, this smoothing width, we can try and estimate what's the timescale of the assembly organization. So here we see the The log likelihood ratio, measured in bits because the logs are to base 2, as a function of this smoothing timescale. And the prediction from space only is this white line that doesn't involve the smoothing timescale. The prediction from the peers only is in purple, but what we're really interested in is this yellow one, which is the space plus peers, and we're interested in the difference between the yellow one and the white one. What's the additional gain we get from the peer cells over the prediction from space alone? And you can see that at very low timescales, the prediction is pretty bad. At very high timescales, we hardly get any more than we would get from space. The optimum comes somewhere in the middle, around here, for this one particular cell. And if we look across the population, we see a very large mode here, showing that most cells tend to have the same preferred timescale, which is in the range 10 to 30 milliseconds, the median being about 25. And I think this is an interesting coincidence, because it matches a lot of the biophysics of the hippocampus. So the first thing is that there's another oscillation, the gamma oscillation, which I haven't talked about at all, but that has approximately this period of 10 to 30 milliseconds. More interestingly, this is approximately the membrane time constant of pyramidal cells, at least as measured in vitro. Even in vivo in neocortex, in the upstates, it's not much below 10 milliseconds, according to the papers that I have recently read. And that's very interesting, because what that says is if you have a group of cells that is synchronized with a 10 millisecond resolution, that will be optimal for inducing spiking in postsynaptic neurons. And finally, 2004, I'll give you the reference right afterwards, I got it upstairs. Yeah, they never... Okay, find me where they say that, because I actually worked with Denis Perret, and I asked him, you know, I asked him for a number, and he refused to give me a number. He likes to talk about resistances. He doesn't like to talk about timescales. Okay, so everyone's very happy to talk about resistances, and Steriard is talking about how it goes down from 30 or 300? I can't remember. Anyway, the resistance can go down by a factor of 3 during the upstate. Now, that's also the range of timescales that we see. I have yet to see anything that convinces me of a 2 millisecond timescale. 10, I will accept that. 2, I really want to see that evidence, because occasionally people say it, but I've never seen the data. So find me the reference, I'd be very, very grateful. But it's a good point. For those who don't know what he's saying, the idea is that the membrane time constant of a pyramidal cell, if you just measure it in a dish, you're measuring the passive properties of the membrane. But in a behaving animal, there are all sorts of synaptic conductances which may lower the resistance and therefore lower the time constant. This particularly appears to be the case in the cortex, where you have these upstates, where you have a very large barrage of input. In the hippocampus, you don't really have upstates, so it's not clear whether it applies. So this is an important point. Okay. Anyway, finally, the point is that this is also about the right timescale that you need for synaptic plasticity. If you have pre- and postsynaptic activity coordinated within 10 milliseconds or so, then you get synaptic long-term potentiation or depression, depending on who fired first. So perhaps this type of thing is no accident at all, but this type of activity is optimal for transmission and storage of information in these hippocampal circuits. Okay, so what does it mean? What's it for? What does it mean that an assembly fires? What's it doing? So now I'd like to go off into just a wild speculation about what this could be. So the first thing we have to wonder is it that there is a sensory information? It's a form of sensory information other than the animal's location in space. We've assumed all the way through that the hippocampus is coding for the animal's location in space. What if that's just wrong? What if it's coding for odors? There's plenty of evidence that the hippocampus firing rates of cells correlates with odors presented. Well, If that's all that's going on, then, you know, suppose this assembly was triggered by an external event, like an odor wafting by, then the external events would need to happen at these very fast timescales of tens of milliseconds, and they would also need to show a relationship with the theta rhythm. It seems very hard to imagine that. There's been some claims of how the sniffing or whisking cycles are entrained with the hippocampal theta rhythm. Those don't appear to have stood the test of time. So it basically seems very unlikely that external sensory input is coming in locked to the theta rhythm. So this one seems like it's not the most likely explanation. I think a more likely explanation is the 800-pound gorilla that's always been sitting in the room of neuroscience, which is the brain doesn't do what we tell it. Animals have minds of their own, and they are completely capable of generating their own internal activity with no sensory correlates whatsoever. That seems to be a more likely explanation for this type of coordination that we're seeing. And that's quite a depressing thought, because that's something we will never be able to control. We can't guess what a rat's thinking, and we can't tell a rat what to think. We'll never be able to control this. But we can at least guess what it might be. So I'd like to go off onto wild speculation now, and guess that the firing of a single assembly corresponds to the storage or retrieval of a single item of memory. The hippocampus is widely known to be involved in memory storage, as well as being correlated with space. This could be a way that the two of them could come together. So why would you have place cells, though? Why would you have place cells? If one of these cell assemblies correspond to the information going in or out of the hippocampus, why would you see any correlation with space at all? Well, rats are very spatial animals. If you try and train a rat to do any association to, say, a light color or a tone, they always wind up making the association to a location in space. Everything they do is based in space. So it wouldn't be surprising if the information going in and out of a memory storage was itself correlated with the animal's location in space. As a consequence, the cell assemblies that would be active would depend, on average, on the animal's location in space. And this is why the firing rates of the cells would correlate with the animal's location in space. This doesn't mean that they code for space. They just correlate with the animal's location in space. It's not that this is what they're for, it's just a correlate of what they're doing, which perhaps is really memory. But it would be enough to explain why you see place fields. Now, that was speculation. I can't think of any way to back it up experimentally, because we can't control when the animal remembers or recalls information. But it's getting late now. I could, if there's enough time, move on to the unpublished stuff, where we try and address this using some recordings in neocortex. Do we have more time, or should we call it a day?
How much more?
10 minutes?
Oh, sure.
Okay. All right. Okay. So the claim is that the assembly activity reflects internal cognitive processes, non-sensory processes that are generated inside the brain, of which memory might be one example. How are we going to test this? Well, it looks pretty hard, because we can't read the rat's mind. We can't measure these cognitive processes almost by definition. But there's one thing we can do. We can modify or eliminate them with pharmacology. And in particular, if we anesthetize the animal, then the cognitive processes should be gone. So we can look at the difference between an awake and an anesthetized animal. And for technical reasons, this is now going to be done in the neocortex. I can tell you why. Basically, it's because hippocampal cells don't fire enough under anesthesia, but cortical cells do. Okay, so I need to just tell you a little bit about the cortical field potential. So in the cortex, you don't have a theta rhythm. What you have instead is the difference between the inactivated state and the activated state. This is a single trace of a recording from, in this case, prefrontal cortex. And at this point here, with the red line under urethane anesthesia, at this point we pinch the animal's tail. And it goes from this inactivated state of large low-frequency oscillations to an activated state of smaller, higher-frequency oscillations. And this is also what you see in awake activity. Typically, you see the inactivated state in slow-wave sleep, and the activated state in waking or REM sleep. And this is the one we're going to look at then, because then this is what you have in waking, where presumably you have the cognitive activities. Okay, so you can also see it in REM. Excuse me? Ah, rapid eye movement sleep, believed to be dreaming sleep. Okay, so...
Why do you actually have to do this with anesthesia? Could you just get them on the sleep and compare REM and non-REM sleep?
Well, okay, so the thing is that, that we want to be comparing like with like. So in this inactivated state, you have huge coordination of the cells, because you have these down states. When you have these positive waves, the cell... Virtually hardly any cells ever fire during these down states, then they all suddenly fire in the up states. So you have a huge amount of coordination. But you could, so what? Okay, so what are we trying to do? We're trying to compare an anesthetized animal with a non-anesthetized animal. Now, is it the case that there's no information processing going on in sleep? That's probably not the case, particularly in REM sleep. Okay, in non-REM sleep, there may or may not be information processing going on. So one thing we could do is we could compare slow-wave sleep with anesthesia, without a tail pinch, to see if there was a difference. If we saw an assembly activity in slow-wave sleep that we didn't see under anesthesia, we could conclude, perhaps, that that assembly activity was related to some sort of information processing going on in slow-wave sleep that was missing under anesthesia. Now, we haven't done that for technical reasons, because there's already a huge amount of coordination just because of the up and down states. That's why we're going to this activated state, because then our job is much, much easier. The EEG has basically no predictive power over the spike trains in this case. So what we're going to do is we're going to compare REM with the anesthetized animal with a tail pinch. We're not even going to look at waking now, because we want to be comparing like with like. We want to compare the same behavior. And the behavior here and here is exactly the same, because the animal is flat out. If he's waking, you could say, oh, it's just the sensory inputs coming in that are making these cells fire. We want to be comparing like with like. So we're going to compare REM and anesthesia. Okay. So did you have Okay, then you're okay, so I had a long chat with an anesthesiologist recently. That's not supposed to happen. Yeah, if you... okay, anyway. But okay, let's just look at the data and... yeah. You mean the sensory input from the tail? Okay, well, okay, so let's look at the spike trains. You'll see they look remarkably different. Okay, so this is REM, but it actually looks fairly similar to waking. Now, you can see that the spike trains are fairly irregular, but there is some sort of coordination between them. And in particular, you have something that looks, perhaps, like a cell assembly. You have certain groups of cells that fire at certain times, looking perhaps a bit like a cell assembly. The most important thing is it's irregular, but there is some coordination between the cells. Now, under anesthesia, it's completely different. It's remarkably different. And this blew me away when I saw this, because I spent a long time thinking there was some sort of bug, because these spike trains are so rhythmic. It's ridiculous how rhythmic these spike trains are. And there doesn't appear to be any coordination. But there's this incredible rhythmicity, which also is happening at different frequencies for different cells. It's California. Okay, so there's rhythmicity in the single cell spike train, but there doesn't appear to be a global coordination. Okay, so let's try and quantify this with a few, so we can use the autocorrelogram. In REM you see there's not much rhythmicity. Under anesthesia there's a huge amount of rhythmicity. The spike train power spectrum is another way of giving us the same information. No rhythmicity in REM, high rhythmicity under anesthesia. And the FANO factor allows us to measure the regularity of the spike trains. Here plotted against bin size, it's always going to be one for small bin sizes. But at large timescales, you can see you have irregular spike trains in REM, but regular spike trains, more regular than Poisson. This red line is what you'd expect from Poisson. More regular than Poisson for anesthetized. Okay, so there appears to be a real difference. So we see all these oscillations. You might expect there's some sort of global oscillation, sleep spindles, whatever, that's synchronizing all the cells together at these oscillations. But that appears not to be the case. Remarkably, appears not to be the case. So here we've got a group of simultaneously recorded cells from neocortex. And you can see of about 100, these are the 8 most rhythmic. And you can see that there's a wide range of oscillation frequencies for these simultaneously recorded cells. And these are the autocorrelograms, and the cross-correlograms are here. And the cross-correlograms are almost completely flat, saying there's no coordination between the cells. Now, you're not surprised not to see any coordination between this cell and this cell, because they have their very different frequencies. But there's even no coordination between cells at the same frequency. And this suggests that the oscillations are coming from a single cell level, not from a network level, but from a single cell level, that the cells are oscillating where they're oscillating independently rather than reflecting a global oscillation. And using the same peer prediction analysis now, we're able to see that in REM, there is a strong predictability showing that there's coordination between the cells, and that this again comes in this time scale of tens of milliseconds. Whereas under urethane anesthesia, despite the fact that the field potential looks the same, the predictability is completely gone, almost completely gone, because the cells are no longer coordinated together. So it appears that in the waking or REM sleep animal, the neurons are synchronized into these assemblies with this type of a time scale. It's also interesting that this appears to match the biophysical constraints that you'd expect for information processing in these circuits. But this assembly organization is gone under anesthesia, although it remains in REM sleep, suggesting that perhaps this is indeed a reflection of the cognitive processes going on inside the brain. And that's it. Thank you. Yes?
We
actually have a possible grant submission about this. It's not just so this isn't just a scientific issue either. Coma is pretty much untreatable, but there's a whole range of states between coma and waking. The persistent vegetative state, but particularly the minimally conscious state. Working with a MD in New York who has a stimulation protocol to the intralaminar thalamic nuclei to try and relieve this minimally conscious state. He's just got FDA approval to do that. Now, the interesting thing is that the intralaminar nuclei are believed to be involved in coordinating large areas of cortex through their widespread projections to layer 1. So one of the things that we may be looking at is what is the effect of an intralaminar lesion on this type of pattern? Whether we would actually go straight to coma, I don't think so. But the interesting thing is that what that would mean is if there is some part of the intralaminar nuclei left, you may be able to actually lift patients out of a coma or out of a minimally conscious state by electrically stimulating them. Yes?
Does this periodic activity vary with age, as in the neonates versus the senile?
Okay, which activity are you talking about here?
Well, this one is circling around 10
I just haven't done those experiments. I wouldn't know. In terms of the membrane time constants, they do change in development. I believe they... Oh, Jesus.
I think it's about the biophysics, more about the quantum, but it's a
lot
of that time learning and organizing and...
Ah, okay. Well, actually, as it happens, we have been doing an experiment with scalp EEG of infants. And what you see is that at around 2 years old, you see a sudden shift in a lot of things. And it happens at around the time of language development that you get an increase in high-frequency gamma band power in the frontal areas, particularly. So that's the one thing that appears to change around that time, is that the power increases in the frontal areas in the gamma band. And if you also, and what we did is we looked at two groups of kids, those from normal controls and those from families at a risk of language impairment. And what you see is that the families, the children at a risk of language impairment show this development of frontal gamma later. And also that the frontal gamma power is correlated with a large number of behavioral tests of cognitive ability of these two-year-olds. So it appears that at a certain point in development, this higher frequency power appears to come up in the frontal regions. That's a very different story, though.
The team has also had your data, frequency when you are searching for the cells.
Well, that's a very good question, and it's still not known. Even for primates, it's still disputed whether they have theta. Some people claim they do. Most recent talk I saw on this seemed pretty sure that they don't. Now, it could be that it's just a technical issue. So the hippocampus in the human is buried deep in the brain. And it's only very rare circumstances where you record from the hippocampus, which is basically when in an epileptic patient where they're searching for the epileptic focus. And in those cases, you can't really have the patient walking around. So there have been some attempts to have them doing a virtual reality maze, and the results have been kind of mixed. And the same with monkeys. Having them navigate in virtual reality, it hasn't been conclusive. Whether you had a freely moving animal, you would see theta, that's another matter. So it's actually not known, is the answer.
So by saying that the pattern is suitable for information storage, you actually mean that basically by synchronizing cells into the 10-to-32nd time window, then that corresponds to standard by timing the 10-to-32nd.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just a striking coincidence that this number happens to, this number of the low tens of milliseconds keeps cropping up again and again and again in all sorts of different places. Another one, for example, is in auditory discrimination. If you have two tones, you need to tell them apart. The time window that you can tell them apart is again about 25 milliseconds. It just keeps cropping up all over the place in the brain, and it seems like this is, you can think of it as like the fastest that anything can happen. That's kind of how I think of it. And if it does match the membrane time constant, that's a good explanation of why.
All these positive correlate cells, you think of those as assembler?
Okay, so one thing that this algorithm never does, it never says cells 1, 7, and 13 are an assembly. What it says is that cells 1 and 9 are more likely to fire together than they would be by common spatial modulation. The way you could interpret that is to say that those cells will more frequently join together in an assembly than other pairs of cells. But you can never say this subgroup of cells forms an assembly. Not with this method. If you did some sort of clustering method, maybe you could. But the problem is that one cell can belong to very, very many assemblies. If all an assembly did was that when one cell, if it was a one for all and all for one type of thing, that when one cell in the assembly fires, all 200 of them will, then why would you even need an assembly? They'd all be doing exactly the same thing. You could do it with just one cell.
Do I understand this correctly? Not necessarily place cells, but are memory cells. But it's
some senses, this is similar to optical network recovery in memory.
Yeah, so the hop field network, which has been around a lot longer than hop field, the recurrent auto-associative network is very much in the spirit of Hebb's thinking. So the point is that you have certain groups of cells whose synapses have been strengthened, and when enough of those are starting to fire, the activity spreads around to the other ones, and it becomes self-sustaining. Now, in an actual hop field network, that's where it finishes; it goes into an attractor. In the brain, that doesn't happen. You have that. This will stabilize for a while, but then perhaps through the refractoriness of these cells or some other process, these cells will stop firing. At the same time, they're also exciting other neurons, and those will take over, and then that assembly will start to fire. And this sequence of assemblies was called the phase sequence, and this is the presumed hypothesized mechanism for these internal cognitive processes.
If this was the case, then why is the phase field so regular? Why is the same cell firing two different places which are...
Well, they're not that regular. I mean, the thing is, there is a correlation between this firing of a place cell and the animal's location, but it's not as strong as, you know, a retinal cell.
And the picture which you've drawn is just a single mode.
Yeah, so I'm as guilty as everyone else of when you put up a figure, you put up the one that looks nice and simple, so your audience thinks it looks, your audience gets the best understanding. But in reality, when I mean, let's see if I can actually show it to you in some of this data. I don't think I can. But this one he's leaving the place field and then coming back, and you can see that here he's come back into the place field. The cell isn't firing at all regularly here, and if you have an animal running through space, if this is the place field, about one third of the time he crosses the place field, the cell won't even fire at all. And when it does fire, it'll fire at widely varying rates, depending on who knows what. These are really very irregular cells. The ISI coefficient of variation for these cells, even running in a wheel, they should have a constant firing rate. Even there, the ISI coefficient of variation is 3. It would be 1 for Poisson. They're much more irregular than Poisson. And either you can say, oh, it's very noisy representation of space, or you can say that it's not only space. And the fact that the cells, the apparent variability of the cells is correlated, to me suggests that it's not only space, that what we thought was random is actually not random at all, it's just a variable that we're not measuring. Oh yeah, I mean even this one displays it. You know, this is a secondary place field here. I haven't showed you this data, but, and it's not, so you could say, one possibility is that he's just run through here once and the cell happened to fire purely by chance, and it's not really a secondary place field. But you get this all the time, that the cell will fire in the secondary place field, say, instead of, here it fires half the time, 1 out of 2 times the animal goes through here, here it fires 1 out of 5 times the animal goes through. You have secondary place fields all the time. Any more questions? Okay, thanks a lot.